Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Hi everybody, Andy here. Just before we start this week's show, I have a little announcement to make. We're in Plug Corner because I have written a book. I have offended again against all the people who say don't do another one, just stop at two, and I've written a third one. And this one, for the first time ever, I've written something that is fun and funny, as well as being gripping. It's called A Beginner's Guide to Breaking and Entering. It's about a young man called Al who lives in gorgeous, empty second homes while the real owners are away. He's got a whole set of rules to help him get into these beautiful houses he could never afford to live in. He has a great life until about chapter 3, when he and his friends break into the wrong house on the wrong day, somebody ends up dead, and everything goes wrong from there. It's funny, it's gripping, it's pacey. There's a little bit of a message about housing in there. It's a perfect summer read. People have been really nice about it. Val McDermid, Lisa Jewell, some of the queens of crime have been incredibly kind about it. It's out on the 25th of April, so if you order it now, you will be among the first cohort globally to receive your gorgeous copy, and they're really nice looking copies. Please do pre-order it. It can really be the difference between a book flying and not flying if it has a few pre-orders under its belt before that crucial first week. It's out in all good bookshops. It's out in all bad bookshops. It's in most bookshops in the Commonwealth, basically. All you need to do is go in and say, I would like a copy of A Beginner's Guide to Breaking and Entering by Andrew Hunter Murray. Waterstones even have signed copies if you'd like to get a hold of one of those. I promise it's good. I've put a lot into it. I'm going to stop banging on about it now. It's called A Beginner's Guide to Breaking and Entering. Thanks very much for listening to this. On with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Alex Bell and I'm joined by Anna Szyszynski, Andrew Hunter Murray and James Harkin. And once again, we are gathered around the microphone to share our four favourite facts from the last 7 days. So in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Andy.
My fact is that half the nitrogen in your body was made in a factory.
Wow. Which factory?
Well, it won't have been made in the UK anymore.
Because of Brexit.
Well, it's a range of factors. but the last nitrogen-making factory, I think, has just shut down.
Has it?
Yeah.
Is that the Billingham manufacturing plant?
Yes,
it is. How interesting. Has that closed? I didn't know that.
It either has done or is about to. But let's zoom out a little bit.
Just thinking, though.
Yeah.
No, let's talk about Billingham.
I'm sorry.
Even if it's just closed, surely it takes a while for all the nitrogen to be replaced. So maybe some of it's British nitrogen
you
in
might,
my body.
You might have some British nitrogen in you, but I'm afraid a lot of it would be filthy foreign nitrogen. All life forms, don't write in, most life forms, mammals and plants all contain nitrogen. It's a really important component in your body. It's required to make the protein in your body and all these various hormones, neurotransmitters. Like, it's vital. You know, nitrogen's very important. And most of the air is nitrogen, right? Mm-hmm. 78% of the atmosphere is nitrogen. But that's not where you get your nitrogen from.
So you can't just breathe in the nitrogen from the air and get it in your body.
No, even if you hold your breath for ages, none of the nitrogen goes in that way. It doesn't work.
What a waste.
But you get it from your food. So meat, fish, dairy, vegetable, cereals, nuts, all of those foods contain some nitrogen, right?
Yeah.
So plants get it from the air. I mean, there's a complicated bacterial process by
I'm
which
sure we'll get there.
Nitrogen ends up in plants.
Or lightning,
and that's another way.
We'll get there as well.
Yeah. The point is that about 2 or 3 kilos of your body, roughly half of your forearm to the end of your hand,
is nitrogen.
Is that where it all is?
So the amount of you made in a factory is roughly your hand and wrist. And that's because nitrogen-based fertilizer has become an enormous thing in the last century. It's incredibly important. It's why the human population has risen from 1 or 2 billion to now 8 billion. Mm. The sole reason is that we have enough ways of feeding people because we have enough fertilizers to grow crops.
Right.
And the way we do that is with this brilliant chemical process discovered at the start of the 20th century, which allows us to pull nitrogen from the sky and make it into fertilizer to make plants grow.
Does this mean I'm not organic?
Yeah.
Shit. I know. What's the point in buying all that nice food?
Nitrogen fixation. Do you remember learning about that? Mm. That was where I sort of lost interest. And now coming back to it, I thought, God, this is fascinating. But poor old nitrogen being told it has to be fixed. Mm. So there's of this conundrum, which Andy sort of touched on, where it's the air's full of it, but plants can't take it in without assistance. And so it needs to be fixed by these bacteria that basically make plant roots grow these nodules, which act as their homes, and then they live in these nodules and they fix this nitrogen, turning it into ammonia, which plants can use.
And the nitrogen came originally from a star exploding.
Ooh.
That's essentially it.
Didn't know that.
The Big Bang can make hydrogen and helium, but anything else needs to be made in stars.
The original nitrogen factory is a star.
Yeah, exactly. Ooh. So some star created lots of nitrogen, then it exploded, eventually it came to Earth. Then eventually it got in the sky. Then eventually a bacterium fixed it. And then it got put into a carrot. And then you ate the carrot. And then it went into your bloodstream. And then it got turned into proteins, which got turned into muscles.
It definitely gets less exciting, doesn't it? Like, part of the journey starts off really well. And then it's sort of seeing in a carrot.
Yeah. So how did we learn to make this stuff?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked.
Oh, it's like Inside the Factory with Greg Wallace.
I love that.
He's like, oh, look at that nitrogen. Oh, yeah, lovely. Oh, yeah. Ooh, yeah, yeah.
It's all thanks to something called the Haber-Bosch process, or Haber-Bosch, sometimes known. So Fritz Haber and Karl Bosch were two German chemists. And the problem, like, everyone knew that we needed more nitrogen at the time, but it was very hard to work out how we're going to actually get it. And we talked about guano, like the guano gold rush, because bird poo contains lots of nitrates. Mm. So that, in the 19th century, was used to increase crop yields, and that saved everyone's bacon, and, you know, it was brilliant for a while. Everyone ran out of...
Yeah, they put it on their bacon.
Bacon, very nice. We're talking about the Haber-Bosch process.
Can I talk about bacon first?
Yeah, go on, yeah, yeah.
You know, bacon is... Most bacon is cured with nitrates.
Right.
As in, that's what makes it last longer, which is a type of nitrogen, or it's a molecule with nitrogen in it.
Okay.
And when it goes green, bacon, that is something called nitrate burn. And it's a reaction to the chemical that's used to cure it. And it means that it's still good to eat. So if your bacon's got a bit green, you can still eat it.
Amazing.
It's not bacteria. It's not anything that's bad for you. It's just a natural part of the process.
I thought it was rotten.
Yeah.
I thought my bacon had gone off.
I'm not saying that all green bacon is good to eat.
No, that's what I've taken away from this.
But if you've bought it only a week ago, it's probably fine. Sorry, Andy, you were saying about Bosch and Haber.
Yeah. So basically, he was a chemist, and it was a very difficult process to work out. He knew that lightning, as you said, James, breaks apart nitrogen bonds, because nitrogen molecules are really tightly bonded. It takes a lot of effort to break them apart, to turn them into ammonia. But eventually he worked out a sort of pressurized process to combine nitrogen and hydrogen, and that makes the ammonia fertilizer. Mm. And he developed that in 1913, Haber. And it was just before the war. And there's a theory that it actually kept the First World War going for longer than it should have done, because German imports of fertilizer were blockaded. But he was able to, he had created a process where you could make, as they called it, bread from air.
So if we stopped any poo from getting over to Germany during the war, they could make their own stuff.
Exactly.
Not poo, but
yeah. Basically, yeah. I mean, that was it.
And he got the Nobel Prize for it, didn't he? Which was extremely controversial.
It was very controversial.
On account of his other legacy.
Yeah, because he made poison gas.
Right.
Yeah. That's so funny. I can't believe the Nobel Prize in 1919 went to someone who'd invented, which gas was it?
Chlorine.
Chlorine gas.
It was quite controversial.
Yeah.
He did kill 90,000 people with it. Not, he didn't go round personally spraying it into the trenches.
Yeah,
but
he was responsible for the birth of arguably 6 billion.
Yep,
so
it's absolutely
swings and roundabouts.
Do you think on like interviews and stuff, he's like, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about my Nobel Prize winning work.
Because his wife, Clara, was a chemist as well.
Mm.
And they had a huge dispute after the first Battle of Ypres.
Yeah.
Where poison gas was used for the first time and killed thousands. He said it was no different killing someone with a bomb or a bullet. She said it is very different. And then she killed herself. She shot herself.
The ultimate act in an argument.
We don't know for sure that the argument is what led to the suicide because she didn't leave any notes or anything like that.
But we know she really... She's fascinating, Clara Haber, and or Haber, if you're a German listening. She was Germany's first female doctor of chemistry. She got a PhD in 1900. And she turned him down. The first time Fritz proposed, she turned him down because she wanted to be financially independent, which is crazy in 1900 as a woman. But she'd gone, hey, I want to live under my own steam. And then she decided marriage would kind of empower her, which it bloody well didn't, which she did complain about. Understandably, she was like, hang on, my husband turns out to be very self-serving, constantly working. I don't have a chance at all to develop my career.
And he's a mass murderer.
And it turns out he's a mass murderer, and that's the final straw.
And he was like, no, no, talk about the other stuff. Talk about the Nobel Prize stuff. Did you see pictures of her? I think she looks a bit like Fenella, Dan's wife.
Oh.
Do you?
Yeah.
I haven't seen a photo of her.
I'm not very good with faces, as we all know.
Right.
But that was what I thought.
And do you associate Dan with Fritz Haber, the mass murdering but mass life producing complex character?
In some ways, but I think Dan is more of a wife guy than Fritz Haber was. So then Haber escaped to Switzerland wearing a false beard.
Amazing.
After the war.
What? Amazing.
And then after World War One, because obviously we had then had the Treaty of Versailles, which really punished Germany, right? And so he came up with the idea of extracting gold from the ocean to pay off all of the war reparations, because he knew that there was loads and loads of gold in the ocean. Mm. And he thought, if I can get at that, we'll be rich beyond our wildest dreams. It doesn't work. And actually, we still can't do it, of course.
What's that term that I think you've told me about, James, for when Nobel Prize winners win a prize and then they come up with a really insane subsequent
idea?
It goes
to their head,
Nobelitis.
Nobelitis sounds like a serious case of seriously sore nobelitis.
But if you'd done it once before, you'd literally made bread from air.
The human
population is going to grow by billions.
That's true. From the guy who brought bread from air comes gold from the ocean. Exactly. It works. Yeah, I believe it.
That works, yeah.
Wow.
And actually, sort of associated, the Nobel Prize in 1935 was awarded for basically being able to turn an element into another element, which was the alchemy that people had dreamed of forever and ever. People had tried to make gold, and actually this was turning boron into nitrogen, which wasn't quite the fantasy of 17th century alchemists.
Yeah. But like these factories were taking already existing nitrogen out of the air and making it into ammonia, which could be used. But Marie Curie's daughter, who won that prize, right?
Yeah.
I can't remember her name, but that was actually making new nitrogen, which no one had ever done before, apart from stars.
Oh. Yeah. So this was amazing. And I didn't realise that the she was the second female to win a Nobel Prize, Marie Curie's daughter. And
was it Marie Curie the first?
Yeah.
Yes.
And it was Nepo baby.
But it was husband and wife as well. So just like Marie Curie and her husband Pierre, who won a joint prize, sweetly, it was Marie Curie's daughter Irene and her husband Frederick Joliot-Curie, who won the Nobel Prize in 1935.
Do you think that maybe they didn't have a chance unless you sort of did stand behind a man a bit? And then
I'm sure there was something of that.
Yeah. Although her surname was Curie, so I think that probably helped.
I think that opened a few doors. Yeah. And also her way of making nitrogen was firing radioactivity at boron, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, in the parents' realm.
Okay.
Yeah, she probably had all the equipment in the garage, like, really.
Exactly.
It's a lot easier when you
And if memory serves, I think she died of leukemia, didn't she?
Younger?
I think Irene did.
Related to the work she'd done?
I'm sure.
Didn't know that.
To be honest, I'm going off memory, but I think that's right.
Because Marie, it was the last thing that Marie almost did was see the results of her daughter's successful test before she died of leukemia.
Whoa.
Yeah, nice.
One thing on the Billingham manufacturing plant.
Oh, thank God. Thank God.
In Stockton-on-Tees in England.
We'd better get a free trip out of this.
It's closed. I'm not going to a closed down nitrogen.
I've had worse day trips out on the QI credit card.
Yeah.
Aldous Huxley went there. They gave him a trip around and he based some of Brave New World on it. So, you know, in Brave New World, they like have a factory making humans, I think, don't they?
Yeah.
And they make clones and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he saw this Billingham factory that was effectively making life by making this nitrogen.
I am imagining like Willy Wonka style. Like, it's so whimsical. And
it's a reverse Willy Wonka, because in Willy Wonka, don't the kids go in and never come out? Whereas in Brave New World, you get loads of new kids from the factory.
The kids do come out. They just come out in all weird shapes and colours. And like, they've all been really quite fucked up psychologically and physically.
Yeah. Every chocolate factory has a nitrogen factory next to it to make new children. Fed to the chocolate factory.
Horrific process.
Yeah. I learned about what I think is the most exciting moment in history. in all of history.
Wow.
As we said at the start, nitrogen, essential for life because it makes amino acids, which make proteins, and that's like the whole building blocks of what all living things are made of. But there's this kind of mystery, which is how did the first life get its nitrogen? Because as we've said, it needs this bacteria to be made accessible. And it can also be made by lightning striking through it, mm-hmm. but actually not enough seems to be generated by that. And it seemed quite unlikely. And it seems like the likeliest explanation for where the very first life ever came from.
So God.
Whatever, 3.5 billion years ago is God. And there we go.
That is exciting.
But hang on, wait. This is like the original chicken and egg, really. What is the actual answer?
So what is the answer? Yeah.
The answer is it happened with volcanic lightning, which I just think Ooh. Is the coolest moment. Mm. It's so basically when volcanoes erupt, then lots and lots of lightning can be generated from the eruption. It's when all this ash goes up. It's a really complicated process, but basically the ash rubbing against each other makes static electricity. And if you look, you've got loads and loads of lightning bolts, hundreds of them, in this volcanic eruption. And scientists have looked at the soil around volcanoes, seen they're full of nitrates, which plants can yeah. use, and realized we think this must be how the first life ever was created, was when shed loads of lightning was firing above a volcano as it was erupting, and it allowed nitrogen to get into the soil in a way that could make
that
life.
That is cool.
That isn't like an origin story I can get behind. I'm so glad it wasn't just like, oh, this cell touched this cell and a fish flopped out of a thing. And like, it's, all of the other origin stories are so lame. That's like Frankenstein, yeah, electricity, yeah, evil laughter, lava. Yeah, it's great.
So metal. Yeah.
James, you just mentioned the Treaty of Versailles.
Yes.
So the Haber-Bosch process is so significant that it was part of the package of the Treaty of Versailles.
No, was
yeah.
it?
The Western powers ordered, via the treaty, Germany to hand over the secret of making these fertilisers.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, that makes sense.
Wow. There's all sorts of stuff they cobbled on to the Treaty of Versailles.
Oh, crazy shit. Right? Yeah.
We've mentioned it in the past, and I can't remember what it was. Something else that's
Champagne.
Really random. Champagne.
They also didn't they want to change the way that orchestras were tuned?
Yeah.
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 Yes,
music.
That's it. Ridiculous. Like, there must have been, like, yeah. And another thing.
It's like having an argument with your partner.
Yeah.
And it
yeah.
starts with something else and you're like, I'm just going to dredge up all these other things.
Yeah. The ultimate argument with a partner.
Yeah.
War. What's champagne? Sorry.
Oh, the fact that champagne can only be made in the Champagne region and anywhere else it's sparkling wine. That comes from the Treaty of Versailles.
Does it? Amazing. I didn't know that. Wow.
I was thinking, like, surely the French already had champagne.
The interesting part of that being that Russia didn't sign it and America didn't sign it, and in both those countries you can buy champagne which isn't from France.
No yeah. way.
So although America didn't sign the Treaty of Versailles.
No,
fact, the First World War is still going on.
They had their own treaties.
They did.
Do yeah. America and Russia have a good culture of champagne? Are they known for good champagne anywhere?
Californian white wine must
yeah,
be
true.
You must be able to make good champagne out of that.
Yeah, just stick an Alka-Seltzer in it. Bob's your uncle.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is Anna.
My fact this week is that Harriet Tubman once walked into a hospital and asked a doctor to cut her head open, and he immediately did. Just mad. So Harriet Tubman, extremely famous in America, probably less well known about here, I would say, but, you know, one of the most influential, famous abolitionists ever, one of the conductors of the Underground Railroad, responsible for smuggling lots of enslaved people into freedom in the 19th century. And one thing that I've learned through reading about her, she was insanely hardcore.
Yeah.
So tough. Cool. So, and this is just an element of it. She was very old at the time. She must have been in her 60s or 70s, I think, in the 1890s. And late 1890s, she's in Boston and she passed this big building and she asked what it was and someone said it was a hospital. And she thought, well, I've had these terrible headaches my whole life. She really had awful like headaches and like terrible vision problems, was probably disabled by it. So she went right in and she said, I saw a young man there and I said, sir, are you a doctor? And he said he was. And then I said, sir, do you think you could cut my head open? And he said, lay right down here on this table.
No.
And sans painkillers, he sawed open her skull and raised it up, apparently. And then as she put it, she got up, put on her bonnet and started to walk home. But her legs did get a bit wobbly and give out under her. So they gave her an ambulance to take her the rest of the way.
It's astonishing.
Yeah, sorry, some questions. Like, yeah. When you say he raised up, is it like a loft extension of her skull? was her brain too big? What is going on?
I think this was a slightly questionable medical procedure, which she said worked and may have been more placebo than
like that. She didn't go and say, my brain is a bit low. I feel like my brain's a little bit low in my head.
It's almost been my neck. Could you just wrench it? Well, she did say it feels more comfortable now.
Yeah.
But apparently refused anaesthetic, bit a bullet, as they did in the Civil War.
That is actually, I'm afraid, a myth, but it's a very interesting subject you raise, Alex, because it's the mythology of her life, which has been so turned into all these stories.
I personally don't believe any of this. It sounds ridiculous.
It is interesting because the more you read, you're like, that's a great fact. And then you read again, someone goes, no, that's a myth.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then a lot of the myths come from relatively close sources, don't they? Mm. Like the first biography of her that was written, there's loads of myths in there.
Well, she never got to write her own. She wanted to write her own. She never got to.
Well, you need to learn to read first, hon.
Yeah, it's true. Well,
that's
have you
a
heard
slam,
this story?
Because she was illiterate.
I was wondering. Slam, it's interesting.
That's how someone brought Harriet Tubman down.
That's why I decided to do a fact about it.
On the reading, did you hear? I imagine this could be an apocryphal tale as well, but there's a story that she was many years after all of her time running the Underground Railroad that she was on a train and a former master of hers got on, and she was a known figure by that point. And so to avoid being recognised, she grabbed a nearby newspaper and pretended to read it because she was known for not being able to read.
Who was on the front cover of that newspaper?
The face was lined up perfectly with the wanted sign. Yeah.
No, I
think it's probably untrue.
That might be because I've heard a different version of it, which is that when she was on one of her missions, because she left the South where she'd been enslaved, and she went back to free former slaves, and you know, she did a lot of that shuttling back and forward. But she was back in the South in 1856, and she overheard some men reading her wanted poster, right, which said clearly, she's illiterate, and then she got out a book and pretended to read it, and the ploy was enough to fool the men.
And they're like, she looks just like Harriet Tubman, but she's reading, so it can't be her.
Yeah. She's reading a normal book upside down. Like, so it can't be but why would you put on the wanted poster that
she can't read? It doesn't make any sense.
It's one of the least relevant things.
No, totally.
And also, I think the idea that people even knew who she was at the time is false. So they knew that there was a person who was helping all these enslaved people be freed. They knew that people were calling them some kind of Moses because they were freeing their people, but they didn't know anything about her personally. And a lot of people assumed it was a white abolitionist who was helping enslaved people.
But it is interesting because I a lot of the stuff you read, you just think that can't be true. And it's not to do down her amazing achievements at all, but it's to show that she's become this like unbelievable cult figure. It's almost mythological, some of the stories around her.
We've got to tread quite a careful line between slamming one of the most sort of beloved and famous women in American history and also sort of acknowledging
she did
amazing stuff.
Find her the most incredible person, one of the most incredible people ever. I don't have the energy sometimes to finish the research for this podcast. And this woman who was like, she was very disabled, she was female, she was black, she was enslaved. Just this extraordinary life. And she fought in the Civil War as well. After being this abolitionist hero, she fought in the Civil War. She was incredibly charitable. I don't understand where she got the energy. And it actually makes me quite angry.
Her injury, her disability came when she was injured by an overseer who threw a stone weight at her head when she was quite young.
He actually threw it at someone else, I think, and it missed and it hit her.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's bad luck. But yeah, she had sleeping spells quite often. So she would just kind of fall asleep. What we'd probably call narcolepsy today. But she would have like these kind of hazy dreams while she was asleep. And because she was very religious, she thought they were kind of premonitions from God.
It's quite stressful, the idea. Let's say you've been enslaved. Harriet Tubman's come back. She's freed you.
Yeah.
She's guiding you to the north. And then she just falls asleep.
It's a bit of a comedy scene.
There is sitcom potential in this life, is all I'm saying. No, but that's...
I think that might be the first time ever someone said there's sitcom potential in Harriet Tubman's life.
Maybe. She went back, she freed... the numbers vary. So she rescued 60 or 70 people herself, personally, and then she gave instructions to another 70-odd. Mm. And that got slightly inflated to 300. But she did go back. I mean, between about around 10 times she made a mission back into the South, which was really perilous.
She also went back at one point to go free her husband, who she'd left, came back, found that he'd remarried. And there's a line which, again, is probably just a biographer, but it's sort of like she thought about making a scene, but then decided against it and rescued him anyway. But it's like the idea again of like the sort of 2 minutes where she's deciding whether to massively kick off that you've married another woman or to save
you. Well, he didn't need to be rescued per se because he was not enslaved. He was a free man.
Right.
Which was kind of a big deal at the time, because a free man marrying an enslaved woman, you would lose a lot of your rights because all your children would be automatically enslaved. You wouldn't be able to get married unless you had permission of the woman's master, as they called them. So that was quite a big deal. But yeah, like you say, once she was off doing her gallivanting, he was like, no, I'm just going to find another wife
remarried.
Now.
Remarried. Yeah. Again, the sitcom is taking shape. You know?
One sweet thing I do like is that when she retired, eventually, she retired into a retirement home that she had founded. So she, in 1908, she opened the Harriet Tubman Home for the Elderly, specifically for like indigent and aged African Americans, as it was described. And
are we sure they didn't misunderstand? And she said, no, I called it the Harriet Tubman Home because it's just a home
just for me.
Here's another good thing. Okay, this is good. And I'm pretty sure this is true as well. So on the missions, when she was taking people over to the North, she would sing, right? And there were particular songs. And some people say she would sing things like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, but that hadn't been written yet. So,
but she was very ahead of her time.
Was
she an England rugby player?
She was, yeah. So there were songs called Go Down Moses and Bound for the Promised Land, right? And those were real songs which she did sing at the time.
Yeah.
And this is a cool thing. She would change the tempo of the songs to indicate whether it was safe to come out or not. So she would just be walking along singing, but the way she was singing was a message to the people she was ferrying north.
Really?
Which I think is cool.
Does that mean, like, you know, if everything's going well and they need to run, did she like go diddling, diddling, diddling? And then if they needed to be slower, she would just do it.
Yeah. And if she stopped singing completely, she's fallen asleep.
I was looking into possibly what kind of brain surgery she had, and then I went on a bit of a journey and found a really fascinating syndrome, which I cannot believe we have never spoken about before, and I feel like we all might have it actually. It's called Forster syndrome, or also known as Witzelsucht, and it's the pathological urge to constantly make puns.
Witzelsucht. Had that for a while. Witzelsucht.
Somebody get a doctor. Fucking hell. So this was first noted in 1929 by a German neurologist called Ottfried Forster, which is what who is named after. He was operating on a patient to remove a tumor, and the patient was awake, as often happens, as was the case with Harriet Tubman. And as he started moving around this tumor, the man suddenly, he was face down, strapped to the table. He suddenly just started talking manically and just like making pun after pun. They were all
tumor?
Based on,
I hardly even met him.
Literally that. It was literally all about knives and surgery. And he'd obviously, because that was what was on his mind, because he was having brain surgery.
Right.
And
literally what was on his mind.
Literally, exactly. Jesus, guys, can you stop? It's absolutely fascinating. And then there have been more recent examples of this. There was a man a few years ago. We just know his name is Derek, he was anonymous, but he had a couple of strokes and his behavior changed in many ways. He used to try and compulsively recycle stuff and things like that, and he started waking up his wife in the middle of the night being like, I've just come up with another pun. And eventually his wife was like, why didn't you start writing them down and not telling me? But eventually realized that this was like a pathological behavior change. And the interesting other side effect is that it's a really simple basic humor, like basic pun connections, basic really basic jokes.
There's a lot of skill involved.
Neurologists studied this and they showed them more complex joke patterns. They didn't find them funny at all, and it's something to do with that really basic pleasure of making a connection in your head. But they also didn't find other people's jokes funny at all.
That's basically every comedian, isn't it?
Another thing about Tubman is that she did get fame by the end of her life and was recognisable, and a bunch of receptions were put on in her honour in the 1890s. They were put on in Boston, and she didn't live there. She had to get a train. But to pay for the train ticket, she had to sell one of her cows. So in order to get to a bunch of receptions thrown in her honour, where she was the star guest, she sold her cow to get the train.
I think she spent so much of her life, in different parts of her life, in poverty, just because she just gave away so much stuff. And when she rescued people from slavery, she used to then follow through and like get them jobs and like set them up in their new places. Stuff they did. She didn't just like get them somewhere and be like, see ya.
Yeah.
She did a lot of cooking too. And that was relevant because she raised a lot of money for the missions by cooking, basically. And there was a really interesting piece about this sort of facet of her life on NPR. So she was once at a market. She came face to face with a former sort of slave overseer, basically, and she was holding two chickens, right?
Oh, yeah.
What did she do?
She pretended to read the chickens.
Brilliant.
She said, oh, looks like there's three cocks in the room.
Very sassy. We're going in the pilot script.
Did she shove her head into a chicken and to disguise herself as a chicken?
She hit him with a chicken.
She threw eggs at him.
She released one of the chickens and then pretended to chase it, causing a comic kerfuffle. Ironically, by drawing attention to herself, she deflected attention from herself.
Again, another scene in the sitcom. That's what happens in Mr. Bean's Holiday. He chases a chicken for like 40 minutes. Comedy gold. Yeah.
So glad we've got the beanographer.
Yeah. I do love Mr. Bean.
So there's a link between her and Queen Victoria, which I find interesting.
Yes.
So in 1897, Queen Victoria sent her a shawl to sort of mark her amazing work.
Yeah, it was a gift.
Yeah, a gift. Yeah, yeah. But I thought I could do a little quiz for you now.
Brilliant.
Who was taller, Queen Victoria or Harriet Tubman?
Ooh, good
one.
Well,
Queen Victoria was no more than 5 foot. I think perhaps less, 4 foot 11.
She was famously quite short.
Famously short.
I believe famously her circumference ended up being more than her height at the end of her life.
Does this help us with Tubman, though?
So Tubman's got to be taller.
I know she was on the small side.
I think she's going to be smaller because it's not a fun quiz because Queen Victoria was quite short. She's probably shorter than most people.
I think the fun ship has sailed.
I'm going to say I think Tubman was an inch taller.
Okay.
I reckon she was 5 foot on the dot.
Okay.
I'm going to say they're exactly the same height.
Brilliant.
I'm going to say Tubman was an inch shorter.
Well, Anna's closest. Tubman was 4 foot 11.
Oh.
Queen Victoria. Now, James, I have read... I went down a real rabbit hole.
I'm sure you're right.
Basically, we know there's a surviving tape measure kept by a portraitist in 1837.
Oh, my God.
Which shows she was 5 foot one. Because she had been... Victoria, I mean, no, not Tubman. Queen Victoria had been claimed to be 5 foot two. And they boosted her height by an inch. That, obviously, it would be ridiculous to say she's 5 foot ten and, you know, really leggy.
Yeah. Maybe she was wearing heels.
Basically, they were a bit embarrassed, the royal family, that she was only 5 foot one. Because it made it seem like she hadn't been fed well in childhood and, you know, like taller children tend to be better fed. They boosted her height, sort of her public height, to 5 foot two so that she would seem a bit better. But the portrait artist had the receipts.
What I think's interesting is that this means approximately that Queen Victoria was about the same height as Sandy Toksvig and Harriet Tubman was about the same height as Susan Kalman.
Yeah.
So if we need people in your sitcom... of Tubman.
I think that's some problematic casting there if you're saying Susan Kalman for the role of Harriet Tubman.
I do see that now, yeah.
Okay, time now for fact number three, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that wasabi is good on sushi rolls and papyrus scrolls.
Lovely.
I beg to differ, personally.
What?
Never tasted papyrus, and yet I reckon I know it's not good.
Ah.
With or without wasabi.
Well, we come to the fact itself.
Oh, he's worded it humorously.
I wouldn't say that's even humorous. It's just a rhyme.
Lyrically.
Right, you've worded it misleadingly in the hope of humour.
No. It charmed me. I found it amusing.
It is not misleading at all. So it's good on sushi rolls because it tastes good, in my opinion. And there are other reasons that we might come to. Papyrus scrolls, though, is the main interesting part, which is this new technique of looking after papyrus. Now, there is a problem that because papyrus is made from plants, it can fall victim to fungal infections and the fungus can damage the papyrus and it can cause the paint to fade and stuff like that. And so there has been a study in the Journal of Archaeological Science which has put some wasabi vapours onto the papyrus and these smells kill off the funguses, or rather stop the funguses from growing very well, and they don't get rid of the colour, so you can still read them. And yeah, this is a lot safer and better for the environment than what you might use before, which is chemicals.
It's super non-invasive because they just put the wasabi near the papyrus.
What I really like in this study is that they didn't want to use actual, you know, ancient Egyptian papyruses, but they wanted to see if it worked on something like that. So they did exactly what you would do at primary school, which is heated up some papyrus to make it look like it was really old. You know, like you might do if you were making a pirate map at school.
Well, did they dip it in tea?
They didn't dip it in tea.
They made new papyrus.
They made new papyrus.
Aged it up fast.
They aged it fast by heating it up.
That's so clever.
Yeah.
And then they mix water and wasabi, almost like if you mix your wasabi with soy sauce, that kind of, you know.
And flush, after the end of the process, you've got a snack.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm less worried about wasting papyri on this process and more worried about wasting good wasabi on this process.
Oh, are you?
It's very precious wasabi. It's very hard to make, isn't it? It's hard to obtain it. And they're just like steaming away wasabi at papyri.
Yeah, and isn't most wasabi not real wasabi? I mean, I've probably never had real wasabi.
I don't think I've ever had real wasabi.
It's mostly been to Japan, though. You must have done.
I have been, but I read that even in Japan, a lot of it is...
I believe most of it in Japan.
Yeah. It's horseradish.
What if I went to a really nice restaurant in Japan?
You're probably fine.
Would it be?
I think 5 or 10% of wasabi served in Japan is real wasabi.
Really?
But in the West, it's like 1% is real wasabi. It's really...
And it's all horseradish. It's all dyed horseradish, yeah.
Horseradish is really strong, but I think wasabi is a bit gentler and a bit more interestingly delicate and a bit more flavoursome. So
that's what I read. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a bit, you can tell if you've got real stuff because it's a bit, should be a bit grittier. Also, I didn't realise that you need to eat it immediately, as soon as it's been grated, because it loses its zing. So essentially you...
Sometimes they bring a root to the table and a grater and you grate it fresh onto your food.
I think I prefer the horseradish. If real wasabi is bland and gritty and you have to have it immediately fresh or it goes off even more.
No one said bland. I just want to say, if there are any chefs out there... Oh, Alex said bland. We didn't say bland.
I believe delicate. And the other thing, the other reason wasabi is good on sushi rolls, so not just because it tastes good, but also because it has antimicrobial properties. So as well as stopping funguses from growing, it can stop bacteria from growing. And it has something in there called 6-methylsulfinylhexylisothiocyanate, which stops E. coli, Staphylococcus, and Salmonella from growing.
Really?
Yeah.
It sounds like we should be taking baths in it or something. It would be good for us as an anti...
I think... Even the delicate wasabi, if you have a bath in it, is going to get right up your nose.
Yeah, fair.
And will cost you a fair few bob.
But you could put it. You could put a bit in your shoes and stop a fungal infection. Or
you could go for a bath, an onsen in Japan, and maybe someone could come over and just grate a little bit of wasabi.
Yeah,
into
that would be
bath.
So lovely. Nice. Yeah, that's luxurious.
You can lick it.
Sorry?
You can lick it and you won't taste the spice.
So there's no point in licking it.
No, unless you don't like spicy food, but you want to eat wasabi, in which case just lick it and then you won't get the spice, but you'll have touched wasabi with your tongue.
If you have fungus or microbes on your tongue.
Yes.
Yes.
That's a good point.
Maybe. I think that should work. In fact, and it's a lot like how lightning can split up nitrate. So by grating wasabi, think of the grater as the lightning, that splits up the wasabi plant and it splits up its cells.
What a tortured metaphor.
How laboured, yeah.
I feel like I could have understood it without any of the previous callback.
Are you sure?
Is that what creates the flavour, do you mean?
It breaks up the cells and creates the flavour,
so
exactly.
Anna, how does wasabi work? Well, let me take you back to the dawn of the universe.
Did you know horseradish is poisonous to horses?
No.
Really?
No. Ouch. So they don't know why it's called that, but I actually like both options. So the word horseradish first appeared in 1597 in English. People think it might be because it resembles a horse's genitalia.
Crumbs. It speaks of a time when more people were familiar with what horses' knackers look like.
True.
You know, exactly. I could probably draw you one, but I would probably
could draw them in bush if I had to. You know, absolutely no, you could do an amazing shaded sketch.
So it's either genitals... horseradish.
Yes,
because they do look a bit like their horseradish is like a mooly. I mean, that's probably less.
What's a mooly?
It's like a long white radish, right?
That's what it looks like.
It's like a long white root.
Yeah.
Are they really big?
Yeah, it's probably, I would say, how big's that? About foot long?
Nah, it looks pretty normal.
I think your mooly simile might have been up there with my confusing lightning simile things clearer.
What's a mooly?
A mooly's like a large radish.
Like a horseradish?
Yeah, that's right. They're similar.
I understand.
I can see this going round in circles.
I genuinely thought people would know what a mooly looked like.
Yeah.
No, okay, fine. What's the other option, Anna?
Well remembered. Thanks, James. It's because, in German, you might be able to guess if I tell you that in German, a horseradish is called Meerrettich, to mean sea radish, actually.
Oh.
Not to be confused with the sea radish, which is a different plant.
I know, because it looks like a seahorse's genitalia.
Yeah, very nice.
You're miles off.
In the older days, everyone knew what that looked like.
Because we all rode seahorses around town, didn't we?
What grows in the sea and looks like a radish?
It's more about
SpongeBob
pronunciation.
SpongeBob SquarePants.
It's about the pronunciation. So when we were translating it into English, we heard mare radish.
Oh, mare, as in like mare the mare, radish. As in a female horse.
As mare. In a horse.
Yeah. Let me give you another reason why it might be called that. Albertus Magnus was writing in the 13th century and he discussed horseradish. He just called it radish, but he suggested it as a treatment for constipation in horses. So it could be that we kind of heard the myrrh, thought we use it for constipation in horses anyway, and so maybe that's why we call it horseradish.
And is it up the bottom?
It didn't say. Albertus Magnus didn't say. He just said it's used for constipation in horses. It might have been up the bum because there's another thing called raphanidosis, which is a punishment in ancient Greece of inserting the root of a radish up the bum as a punishment for adultery. Mm. Now, we don't know what kind of radish that was. It probably wasn't one of those little red ones that you get in Sainsbury's.
That's the first offence.
Exactly. But if it was horseradish, for instance, then that would be much more of a punishment because you're going to get that kind of wasabi burning up the bum as well as having something that's the size of a moolie going up your bum.
Size of a moolie.
I bet there was one person who got really turned on by it.
Do you think?
I bet there's one example where someone was like, oh no, I adulterated again. Get the hammer.
Familiar with the stories of ancient Greece, Alex. Yeah. Here's the thing on papyrus. Mm. Right. Oh my goodness. Okay. You know the Library of Alexandria?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm. Okay. Ancient Egypt, founded in the 295 BC.
Yeah.
They had a copy of every book, or they were trying to get one. So the Ptolemies, with the pharaohs at the time, they're all called Ptolemy, basically. And they would hunt for manuscripts everywhere, right? And they would send out, if a foreign ship sailed into Alexandria, it was searched for scrolls, and then they'd be confiscated and copied out and then given back. And all of this was on papyrus, right? Uh-huh. And the Nile Valley was the center of the written word because papyrus grew on the banks of the Nile. Mm-hmm. So the Ptolemies have basically, they control supply.
Yeah.
And then there's this rival library that sets up. King Eumenes of Pergamum founds a rival library, the Library of Pergamum. And Pergamum was huge at the time. It was a big kingdom, like massive.
Turkey.
Modern day Turkey. And more. You know, they were a big deal, the Pergamites. I don't know. Anyway, basically, talk about sitcom potential. There's this spell in history.
Makers of Harriet Tubman, !!
There's this spell in history where both libraries are trying to secure every book on the planet. And like they are bidding huge wages for scholars, like Premier League footballers for scholars and scribes. Some scholars are imprisoned, so they can't run off to the other library. And then the huge move happens. Ptolemy V takes the rivalry to a new level about 100 years after the founding. He bans the export of papyrus. Huge move.
Ouch. That's cheating, isn't it?
Yeah. Eat it,
That's
Pergamum.
Like taking the football off the pitch.
It basically is. You can't make any scrolls. You can't copy any manuscripts. We own literature. Huh. And so what did Pergamum do?
Well, he
invented paper?
Yes, he must have invented paper.
The audiobook. He invented the audiobook.
They started manufacturing parchment from the skin of animals. And parchment literally means from Pergamum. That's the etymology.
Way.
That's so cool.
And the thing about parchment is you can cut it up in layers and you don't need to roll it in a scroll, which is incredibly inefficient.
You can have pages.
You can have pages.
Huh. That's so interesting.
That is where, like, parchment already existed, but they, as it were, put a lot of manufacturing behind it and made it bigger, you know. And the book is better than the scroll.
Wow, the pen is mightier than the sword, and the book is better than the scroll. Do you know what, Andy? I'm going to come out and say it. That etymology is even more interesting than the horse genitalia.
Wow.
Well done.
Wow.
Yeah, strong disagree.
Okay, it's time for our final fact, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that bees smell like bananas when they get angry.
I've never seen an angry banana.
So I think this is just a weird coincidence, really. Bees use pheromones a lot to communicate. Like they release different chemicals which other bees can smell. One of the pheromones that they release is a distress or alarm signal. Maybe there's a predator, one of their bees is in trouble, makes them really angry too. And one of the chemicals in this pheromone is called isoamyl acetate, and that also happens to be the chemical which is banana flavor.
Yeah. Mm. Can I just say, because I think people often say what you would know as banana flavor is actually this very specific banana thing. Most people know banana flavor from actual bananas, right? I mean, I don't have that many banana flavored things.
Have more people eaten bananas or eaten a banana flavored Angel Delight, maybe, or one of those little.
I'm going to go out there and say more people have eaten bananas than banana flavored Angel Delight.
Well, that's because bananas have an entrenched advantage, you know. Arguably, banana flavored Angel Delight is better than a banana.
If it grew on trees.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But you have hit the point that banana flavor, artificial banana flavoring today is not quite the same as the bananas we eat today.
Yeah.
You have mentioned this on the podcast before, and there was a previous species of banana or strain of banana called the Groming Shell banana, which used to be all around the world.
It's extinct.
It got nearly, I think it's still around in Thailand somewhere, but it's not commercially really available or used. It was like nearly completely wiped out, if not completely wiped out.
By the Angel Delight market.
Yeah. So we eat Cavendish bananas now, I think.
Yeah,
now.
We eat Cavendish
and they're supposed to be less tasteful. And so actually the slightly tangier, stronger artificial banana flavour in those tiny sweets that we get.
And that's the one that you get from the bees.
The bees, yes.
And people, it is a renowned thing in the bee community. I was messaging Liz, who is one of our colleagues who's been at QI longer than all of us, in fact. And she's a beekeeper as well. And
you mean Liz?
Unbelievable. She says, yes, sometimes you will enter the hive and there's a real banana stench.
Is there really?
And they also say don't go near a hive with a banana. Is the other thing to do.
Because it'll annoy them.
Yeah, absolutely. Because they'll think it'll remind them of
a large bee.
Yeah.
Especially if you paint black stripes on the banana.
I think it's the equivalent of walking into a hive with a big sign that just says, I killed your friends.
Don't also go to a beehive with a pregnant mouse.
that's where I went wrong.
Yeah.
So pregnant mice smell like bananas.
They do.
Do they?
Yeah, they do. It's a scent that they give off. And it also stresses out male mice. Isoamyl acetate.
The smell of a pregnant female mouse.
Yeah, it does.
Stresses out males.
Yeah, because mice are often cannibals and they will eat baby mice.
Uh-oh.
But not if you make yourself smell like a banana. The males will go, ugh, I'm not going near that, and they won't eat your children.
That's so ironic.
Yeah.
They won't eat you if you make yourself smell like a banana.
What kind of a fucked up world is it? We're like, delicious children. Oh, it's got banana on it.
But I didn't know the range of pheromones that bees use.
There's so many. There's a massive list online. Yeah.
There's extraordinary, weird things that they can do. So, for example, the queen... There was a great
article. She used to have bees, didn't she?
She smells of bananas.
Queen Liz.
Brilliant. I found a piece on this from 2014. I just want to give a shout out to Luke Holman on The Conversation. I don't know if he wrote the headline, but it was called Smells Like Queen Spirit. Fantastic.
So good.
So nice. Queen bees, they broadcast data via pheromones to the rest of the hive. And one of the things is to say they are the queen. That just communicates, you know, clear leadership in place. Another is whether or not they are mated and have been mating around, and also how well mated they are. So they have pheromones to release to say how many males they've had sex with.
Imagine if our queen did that. It would be so funny. She's opening a school and you're like, oh.
More promiscuous queens are better for the colony because they provide a bit more genetic diversity. And that keeps the colony nice and healthy.
Yeah. But also every queen has to... I was reading this interestingly about how you introduce a queen to a colony. If you just take your queen and plonk it in, the bees will kill it because she's got the wrong pheromones. She's from another hive. Mm. And the worker bees need a chance to get used to her. So the way that you do it is that you have a box and you put this box in the hive and the doorway to the box is sealed up with sugar, basically. The bees eat through it and it takes them a while, but it means that they end up being quite close to the queen who's sitting inside the little box waiting to be released from the box. And so the time it takes for the bees to eat through the sugar, they can smell the queen on the other side and they get used to her and then they don't want to kill her.
Oh. So it's like she bursts out of a cake. It's the
yeah, she
of
actually
that.
Does, yes. That is exactly how every new queen is introduced to a beehive.
Another use of isoamyl acetate is to make fake bananas. And this happened during World War II. Let's say we've stopped any poo getting to Germany and they've said, right, well, you're not having any bananas then. So you can't get any bananas there, so you have to make fake ones. And they made mock bananas by using parsnips. They would get some parsnips. They would add some isoamyl acetate, which was available banana essence, essentially. And they would eat them. And apparently there was a modern day blogger called Carolyn Ekin who recreated it and said it's a rather strange and bizarre taste, but not unpleasant, although there is a aftertaste of parsnip.
I think it's so tragic. The yeah. idea of like, I mean, yeah, that, that mash was, up your parsnips,
that
add
was
some
the
sugar.
War.
Mm, yeah. Bananas. Yeah, no, it really was.
When a queen bee dies, she stops releasing the pheromones that she's been using to keep the, you know, colony happy and placid. And this causes a big reaction, and the workers basically get going on an emergency queen. So this is really interesting. They build these huge queen-sized chambers, like queen-sized bedrooms, effectively, and they get 10 to 20 candidates, workers, and they start feeding them royal jelly, and they find out who becomes the queen.
That sounds like a reality format.
It actually is. Yeah. And the first one to emerge kills all the others and then begins to lay eggs. And that's...
We won't make it past the ethics committee at the BBC, I don't think.
Yeah.
There is only one pheromone which two dung beetles share. Okay? So most dung beetles have their own pheromones, but there's one that's shared by both of them, and it's called anisole.
Where do they release it from?
It comes because it smells a bit like anise, like star anise.
Oh, that is anisole. A name that works, I'm sure, brilliantly in the French market.
Isn't there a whole thing where beavers' anal glands are the origin of an awful lot of chemicals?
Castoreum.
Flavours, including...
Well, vanilla.
And durian. Strawberry, raspberry flavouring. They're not necessarily used anymore, because I think it's still quite rare and expensive, and also people don't really want that on...
Only 5% of strawberry angel delight is actually beaver anal gland juice, sadly.
And if I went to really nice restaurants, I did really get beaver anal glands.
Don't worry. In your angel delight...
anal delight.
Can you guys smell ants?
Oh my god, the ant detector's going off. Everyone line up, pick up something much heavier than you, and file out of the building.
I'm not asking right now.
Yeah.
I'm saying in general, if there was some ants on the table, do you think you'd be able to smell them?
No, I don't think I would.
Yeah, so the interesting thing is that this is a thing that people have said on the internet. A lot of people have said, oh, I can smell ants. And then other people have said, you can't smell ants. And then there's been big arguments. It's not like the internet to argue over something completely pointless. But IFL Science, which we all love, that website, they carried out a Twitter poll. And they found that 20% of respondents claim that they can detect the odour of an ant, compared to 80% who can't.
Hmm.
Ants are heavily dependent on pheromones. Were 20% of respondents ants?
Don't know. Well, we don't know exactly. I think one thing we can say is that this is not a particularly scientific survey.
Right.
But let's say, for instance, it is true. There are various different reasons that it might be true. It could be that some people have a certain gene that allows them to smell ants, like you can smell asparagus wee. Some people can, some people can't. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It could be that some ants smell, and the ones that live in certain areas smell, and the ones that live in certain areas don't smell. Yeah. And that's the responses we got, but we don't know.
Or they're living in smelly areas, and we're smelling other things, and it's covering them up. If I'm in like the ground floor of John Lewis, like I'm not going to smell an ant because it's the perfume section.
Yeah, absolutely. So if all of the UK's smelly ants live in perfume sections of John Lewis, we would never smell them.
That's a very relatable comparison point.
It's just something, it's a bugbear of mine.
How often?
Because I like going to John Lewis. I nearly pass out every time I go in. You have to sort of...
Oh, I love walking. I love walking past the perfume section in the department store.
No. Yeah,
I really like it.
Yeah. I really like going in an airport and trying out all the samples.
Yeah, me too.
Do you?
Yeah, yeah.
And then getting on the plane and really offending everyone.
I've never tried that. I should do it.
You should do it,
honestly. Through the duty free, as you go through that windy
bit. As you go through the duty free, there's loads of free samples.
Mm, that's another bit I hate because it smells so awful, as in so strong, and it like gives me headaches.
So you've probably got quite a sensitive set of pipes on you.
There's definitely an ant in this room.
Right.
Quite a lot of hotels have got cameras in their bedrooms these days. In the beds, in fact.
What? Where's this? What?
Bee hotel. What?
Do you mean bee
hotels? Human
hotels.
Oh, human hotels. So this is something called the spotter gadget. It's got loads of pheromones in it and a tiny camera, and you put it in a hotel bed, and the pheromones attract bed bugs. And then when the bed bugs go into where the pheromones are, the tiny camera takes a photo of the bed bugs and sends it off to someone who looks at it and goes, yes, that's a bed bug.
Goes, poor.
And then if they say, yes, it's definitely a bed bug, then it means that you have to go in and fumigate it.
That is exterminators in.
Yeah, yeah.
But so these are in hotel rooms.
Yeah.
But can the camera capture anything else that's happening in the hotel room?
If your penis is the size of a bed bug.
Oh, dear.
Then perhaps.
It was just drawn to that little tube. I didn't know.
Okay, that's it. That's all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch with us, we are all available on social media. I'm on Instagram at Alex H. Bell. James?
I'm on Twitter at James Harkin.
Andy?
Me too, at Andrew Hunter M.
And Anna?
You can get in touch with the podcast by Twittering at No Such Thing or on Instagram at No Such Thing as a Fish, or you can email podcast@qi.com.
That's right. And you can also subscribe to Club Fish if you'd like to get the ad-free version. And you can buy merchandise from our website and all
sorts of... NoSuchThingAsAFish.com.
NoSuchThingAsAFish.com. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back again next week. Goodbye.